Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
MotoGP at Jerez in Andalusia is one of the MotoGP races a rider must win. It's almost as if the race should be worth a couple more points than the normal 25. It's in the sport's heart. It's full of tradition. In the sunshine yesterday was Simon Patterson. Valentin Hurunshi was reporting on the weekend for the race, and they joined me, Toby Moody, to talk about Jerez, a place that I first went to in 1996 when the passionate crowd were so excited about Spaniard Alex Crivier potentially winning the Grand Prix that they spilt onto the racetrack on the last lap, ultimately causing him to lose the race. But it gives you an idea of how passionate they are about motorcycle racing in that part of the world. But we're here to talk about 2022, and we're here to discuss Pecco Bagnaia being back on form. The Ducati rider, he set a pole record, he won the Grand Prix, he set a fastest lap record as well, he got the whole thing yesterday. Fabio Quartararo now has a championship lead from being level with Rins to 7 points ahead of Aleix Espargaró. Is this going to be another season of Quartararo versus Bagnaia, Yamaha versus Ducati? Suzuki and KTM, it wasn't a race really for the family album. And something that fascinates me, has Quartararo re-signed? I personally think he has, but we will discuss it. So then, let's kick it off with the winner, Pecco Bagnaia, the Italian, the fastest ever race pace over 25 laps at Jerez was set by Bagnaia yesterday. From a season's best so far of 2 fifth places, he's finally now got a win. Simon, is this the turning point?
It very much looks like it, but we have seen false dawns before this season with Bagnaia, so I'm not getting too excited about it just yet. It's don't get me wrong, it is by far the best performance he's given this year, and it does build on what looked like some good form from last weekend in Portimao, although that didn't quite translate into the race after he bashed himself up really badly in qualifying. But to come into this weekend still nursing an injury, to deliver not just the race performance he delivered, but the qualifying performance, because this is a circuit where the top 15 have been separated by a second all weekend, and the guy went half a second quicker again. It's not a track where you can do that. It's tight and it's twisty. So I think that more than anything showed to me that he's got that front feeling that's been missing back again. We need to see, of course, how it translates to other circuits. Le Mans will be a good test of that, and Mugello will be a good test of that after a disaster for Bagnaia last year where he crashed out of the lead at his home race. So I think if I were in the Ducati camp today, I would be very, very happy with that, but I maybe wouldn't quite be counting all my chickens before they've hatched.
Yeah, equally, I would not be jubilant quite yet if I was Ducati, because I agree with Simon. It did feel like Bagnaia's season threatened to get underway at several points, especially by what he was saying. But obviously, this was an entirely different level of performance. I think defeating a fully fit Quartararo at Jerez is maybe one or two steps removed from defeating Marquez at Cota or defeating Marquez at the Saxon Ring. Because, I mean, you might disagree because there's less of a body of evidence, but those two were like 11 seconds up the road compared to everybody else. Clearly, normally we would have expected Fabio to absolutely walk this race. And the fact that Pecco not only went, you know, toe-to-toe with him, but won and absolutely smashed the absolute hell of the lap record, it says a lot. It says that he's rediscovered certainly at least that peak level. So Yeah, it really could be Quartararo versus Bagnaia again. 33 points is not... It's not an unassailable gap, certainly at this point in the season. And it, I did already sort of have a thought of, is this sort of Lorenzo Rossi 2015 again, where Lorenzo spotted Rossi a bunch of points in the beginning, but was quicker over the course of the season and ultimately made it up in controversial fashion? Maybe. We'll see. Still such a long way to go. But this was as convincing and as informative of a win as, honestly, we've seen all season, I guess, yeah.
Or ever, even from Bagnaia. I mean, Simon, you know, you both said it. The domination was quite something. And as you say, Val, to be 11 seconds up the road, that doesn't happen anymore. So it really does set the pair of them apart. Bagnaia did say after the race that he had stopped trying to change the bike to him, and instead he has morphed himself into the bike. Now, if he has crested that hill, if he's made that big change, and it can transpose over to the Le Mans, the Mugellos, the Catalunyas, the Assens that we've got coming up, then those 33 points are bridgeable with, what have we got, 15 Grand Prix still to go, 25 points per victory. So, and of course, you touched on it as well, Simon, you know, still injured with that shoulder from Portugal. He took a lot of painkillers after the warm-up, so he was riding not 100%.
I mean, I think he probably was riding 100% because he was so much pumped full of painkillers. But that's a separate issue. There's a belief in some sports these days that if you need that many painkillers to ride, then you're not fit to ride in the first place and shouldn't be out there. But that's not MotoGP policy right now, so let's not get too into it. It is worth remembering, though, that Bagnaia's real title challenge last year didn't come until the second half of the season. And that has to be the most worrying factor for Quartararo right now. The guy won four out of the last six races, probably should have won five of them if it hadn't been for the pressure of fighting for a title that made him crash out in Misano. So let's see how he continues
to build.
Wrong tire
choice that day, to be fair to him.
Yeah, but also a lot of pressure on his shoulders, and he has a history of falling off under pressure at Misano, in fact. I think that the way that he spends the next few races will be very telling to us, because the R-Tracks last year where he had a bit of a nightmare. If he can come out of those fighting strong, then Quartararo has a real, real problem in his hands.
Yeah. 33 over 15 races is entirely possible to make up. But I do think Bagnaia was actually, as much as his title challenge didn't really begin in earnest until the second half of the season, Bagnaia was actually closer to the lead at this point last season. So it's, you know, it's a question of whether this Jerez result is something that's very, very repeatable, the way that last year's run of nearly five wins in six races was. But again, if it is repeatable, then honestly, the points don't really even matter. Like, if you can do this on a week-in, week-out basis, I think as good as Fabio has been this season, I think he's proven that the Yamaha will not let him do this kind of thing on a week-in, week-out basis. There will be tracks with straights long enough where it just can't do it. I mean, Fabio keeps maintaining that the race he rode in Cota to seventh was no different in terms of his performance level to his Portimao win or Jerez second place. And if he's correct, then there's going to be, and certainly he seems to anticipate trouble on the horizon. And if he's correct, there's going to be trouble on the horizon. There's going to be days where he's going to have bad points days. Even though there's another crucial difference in that Bagnaia falls off sometimes and Fabio basically never does. So there's a few layers to this potential fight if it does materialize. But it's very fascinating, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, if we drift on to Quartararo, he has now scored 45 points from 50 in the last two Grand Prix. Looking forward, just as we did last week, let's just repeat those stats. Le Mans last year, he was third. Now, the difference with Le Mans this year is that there's going to be a big crowd in. Simon, there wasn't a big crowd last year at Le Mans, if much at all, sort of 20,000. Help me out here. Small.
We're just numbers. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't tell you the exact number, but it was less than half capacity for a race that's normally one of the biggest of the year.
But my point is, yes, there was a full crowd there in 2019, but he was a rookie and he was a bit under the radar. He's now...
He was also just coming off an arm pump surgery.
Yeah. He's now a French reigning world champion going to the French Grand Prix. So he's got something else to worry about when he goes to Le Mans. Catalunya, he won in 2020 and he was sixth last year when his leathers popped open. He was easily going to be on the podium otherwise. Assen, he won last year. Mugello, he won last year. So again, the Yamaha tracks coming up. The tracks coming up are going to suit the Yamaha, should I say. But Yamaha must be wary, as you've touched on, that Ducati made the step change in the second half of last year. What can Yamaha bring after the summer break? What have they got up their sleeve? That's maybe a question we need to chase up for next week by ringing around a couple of people. We'll talk about that. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. Quartararo in the race said, I tried to overtake Bagnaia in the early laps. I couldn't do it. I was going to get worried that I was going to get stuck behind him because then the front tire temperature would go up and then the pressure would go up and it would be like riding the front like a pea on a drum. It would be a bit pingy. But he also said that then the compound went over and it was like riding on plasticine. It was all a bit squishy. But he did sensibly say, I know I have limits. You know, I understood that the points were there. Don't be greedy. Take the 20 points. So that's the mindset of a champion still at 22 years old.
I mean, he gave it a go. I think if he properly settled for points, there was a moment where the pit board came out and it showed that the Yamaha team was telling him that next up the road, Miller was 7 seconds down the road. And it sort of read like a message from Yamaha, like, hey, if you need to, the 20 points is yours. So don't go nuts. And I think he still gave it a proper go. I think he maybe had a couple more tenths, maybe one more tenth than Bagnaia of ultimate pace, but is never gonna make his way past Ducati with that sort of gap. And even then, I'm honestly not sure because they were both absolutely riding out of their mind in terms of relative pace to the other guys. Like, I mean, this is going to be slightly a mean comment, but the whole MotoGP field was saying, oh, it's so close at Jerez. It's so close at Jerez. You never know who's going to win. Like, there's going to be 15 riders who can win. And we've had a race where somebody's on pole by half a second, and then there are two riders who absolutely blitz the hell out of the rest of the pack. It wasn't close at Jerez at all. There were two guys, and then there was the rest of the field. You know, MotoGP it's still like that sometimes. Still, for all the level equality of the grid, we still have weekends like this where people just disappear into the sunset.
The one thing that I think is quite telling maybe about why he couldn't get past is listening to the comments from Aleix Espargaró about the battle for third. He basically said he was sitting behind Marquez and Miller waiting for one of them to make a mistake because he thought that was the only way it was possible to get past because Jerez is such a hard circuit to pass. And I think that's why maybe when you think back to the iconic Jerez overtakes, they're all big, spectacular movements because they have to be. You can't do a normal block pass at this track to get past. You know, that's why we've got Gibernau versus Rossi in 2005. Why we've got, you know, do you remember the amazing Eugene Laverty overtake on Marco Melandri in World Superbikes in 2013 at the last corner that was basically mirrored yesterday in Moto 3 by Izan Guevara? Those sort of around the outside, those sort of moves are the big spectacular Jerez overtakes. And I think when you've got two guys who are so equal, but who, especially with the Yamaha behind, which, you know, it is a difficult bike to overtake on because it carries corner speed and doesn't brake as hard. I think that, you know, I tweeted at the start of the race to say if Quartararo leads lap one, the race is over. In the end, it was Bagnaia that led lap one and the race was over. But I think that could have went either way. It was very much something that was decided as the lights went out because of the nature of the circuit. Maybe if Bagnaia was P2, he would have been able to stick on and overtake in the slipstream. But similarly, maybe Quartararo would have been used the better corner speed to break away from them. But the two of them were so well matched that I think there was, that was just the nature of the race.
Have Ducati
said anything or Bagnaia said anything about how he has morphed himself into the 22 bike?
Everything that they've said has been that it's all been kind of working from both sides, that he hasn't had to make huge changes. He's had to make big setup changes, but it's all been to try and get him a bike that feels roughly like one that he wants, roughly like last year's, just a little bit better here and there because it is a new bike and they have tweaked a few things. But I think I get the impression that they kind of went much further away in the opposite direction over testing, and that really messed them up at the start of the year. So both parties have come back to what they're a bit more comfortable with now. So it's maybe
particularly at a track where they tested at.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they did and they didn't, because let's remember the engine spec has changed.
True.
Since they were here, and that was one of the big problems. The initial touch of the throttle and how aggressive it was one of the big problems. So that test will have been beneficial, but not beneficial to the extent that other manufacturers will have been.
Interesting. But as Val said, he's 33 points back. He's Bagnaia at the moment with those 15 Grand Prix to go. So, you know, that'll just fizzle away. It's 3 points a race, isn't it? You know, 2 points a race. It's done. But Bagnaia has had a non-score, which was Portugal. Sorry, I'm talking rubbish. He fell off at the first race. He fell off at the first race in Qatar. But as you quite rightly say, Val, Quartararo at the moment, commentator's curse approaching, scores. And even if it's a bad day, it's still got a number in it and not a dash and not a zero, which is how the championship table is printed out by the FIM. So interesting times. Ducati not out the woods yet. Yamaha not running away with it either. We got a championship. We've got now it distilled down and we've only just started Europe. Normally we get to this kind of, it's going to be between those two. And it's thick end of Saxon Ring, middle of July, isn't it?
I'm not sure it is just between those two, though. I genuinely think that there's an Aprilia threat. I think that Aleix Espargaró's consistency at the minute means that he is a threat as well, because it seems like the new Aprilia just does not have a bad weekend. You know, they're just there every weekend now, consistently. We've seen Mir use a similar strategy in a complicated season to win a championship, 2020. And while I think this year will be a little bit tougher to run that strategy with Bagnaia and Quartararo both looking quite strong, there will be tracks where both of them, well, we've already seen that there's been tracks where Bagnaia struggled. I think we'll continue to see tracks where Yamaha will struggle again as well. I mean, no one's expecting them to win at the Red Bull Ring, but an Aprilia fighting for the win at the Red Bull Ring this year would actually be, looking at the strengths of their bike, quite a reasonable proposition. So, I am very curious to see how the title fight plays out. I think we have our two contenders, but we don't have all the players in position yet.
Yeah, I still find it a little bit hard to believe just in terms of peak performance. We did see Aleix walk away with it at Termas, but that was a bit of a weird weekend. He could be in the mix. Yeah, I think if either Bagnaia or Quartararo go on a run of those really, really good weekends, which happens sometimes, he might be left in the dust. But if shenanigans begin, then maybe, because the Aleix looks really good and the Aprilia looks very, very versatile. Like when the big weakness of your bike is the clutch, as Aleix put it yesterday in the press conference, that means that, you know, the actual lapping part of it is more or less sorted. Like, obviously, it can still get a little bit better, but there's nothing glaring there. And, you know, it qualifies well, it races well. He always looked like the third best guy in yesterday's race. I was always, even though the passing is clearly very difficult, I was always reasonably confident that he was going to get past both Marquez and Miller. Ultimately, took a dive bomb on Miller and Marquez nearly falling off the bike. But the pace, like once he was in the clear, as he says, he checked out from them immediately because he was the third quickest rider in that race. He even suggests he could have followed Quartararo Bagnaia, which I don't know. That sounds optimistic to me, but it's a good day for a bike that, you know, continues to impress with how versatile and how reliably one of the quicker ones it is.
And let's not forget that a few short years ago, whenever we were talking about Alesh said that he was waiting behind Jack and Mark, waiting for one of them to make a mistake so he could get through. A few years ago, it would 100% have been Alesh that you were sitting behind waiting for a mistake to get through on, because he would have done something dumb. So he's riding with a new, more sensible approach this year. And, you know, they said, I did an interview before the first race with Massimo Ravola, the team manager, and Massimo listed off five or six circuits where he thought that Aprilia could win at this year. Now, one of them wasn't Argentina. The only one of them we've been to so far is Qatar. So there's another four rounds, Silverstone, Phillip Island, Assen, Aragon, where they think that they can win. And if he can stay this consistent throughout the season, be top five at every round, stick in four or five victories, he is 100% a podium contender. And obviously, yeah, the one weakness that he singled out now is the clutch off the line. But that's something that can be replaced in season. And I'd imagine that's something that they've got a big box of new parts to test today.
I don't think you're being fair. I don't think Alesh would have fallen off a few years ago running in tow of somebody. I think the bike would have exploded.
That too.
Yeah. And without having the rule book to hand, I think if you're going to test a load of clutches, you can go to an airfield down the road in Italy. All you got to do is standing starts and just run it up to 200 clicks. That's all you need.
Yeah, because the rules doesn't limit the amount of test days you can do. The rules limit the amount of Michelin MotoGP tires you're allowed to test on. So that's something you can do with street tires at the end of the day. It's something you could do in a dyno.
Yeah, you haven't got the wind resistance, but I know what you mean, Simon. Yeah.
Yeah, but if it's the mechanical feel that's the problem.
Yeah.
Then it doesn't have to be done on a racetrack.
And if it's wearing out or something that's not right, then you can do it on a dyno, because all you got to do is wear it out.
Exactly.
And then work out. But if it's only off the start line, it's very odd that it's wrong between the start and the first corner, which is only about 5 seconds.
But that's the only time these guys are using a clutch, don't forget.
Correct. Yes, exactly. And it's the only time they touch the lever. So, yeah. Well, let's see. Aprilia, on the podium is the norm, and they are dishing out a large amount of embarrassment to many other teams. They are third in the Constructors' Championship. And remember that they only have two bikes, and it's the first bike in your brand over the line that scores the points. So if you've got more bikes, you've got more chance, a la Ducati. And Aprilia a second in the team's championship out of 12 teams. I mean, it doesn't get talked about enough, and I do talk about it on this podcast because I've been a member of a team, and it's important for a team that you are up in those different championships rather than just the riders' championship. But the great thing is, doesn't Argentina seem a long time ago when he won the race? We're like, yeah, he's on the podium. Yeah, fine. How things change for Aprilia.
And two front row starts since then as well.
Correct.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mark Marquez at Jerez in 2022 said, "Today I gave my maximum and I achieved the maximum. I saved my energy through the whole weekend to be ready for Sunday because I'm still not in the condition to do a whole weekend at 100%. He crossed the line in fourth position, a couple of seconds back of third place Aleix Espargaró. But of course, the highlight for so many people on social media, watching on TV, was him picking it up on his knee whilst passing Miller, but ultimately then letting Aleix Espargaró go through at the last corner with half a dozen laps to go or so. He sounds reasonably sanguine and not happy, but that's it. I couldn't do any more. Is that the vibe you got?"
Well, he's sanguine because he has to be sanguine. The way he put it is, "If I don't set myself realistic targets right now, I'm going to be frustrated. And that's no good for everybody, for anybody." So if Mark was 2019 mode Mark, obviously he'd be really frustrated with fourth place at Jerez, but he's not that Mark right now, and we don't know that he'll ever be anymore, and the bike's different and he doesn't know it as well. He tricked me good this weekend, because on Friday there was no pace and I thought that everything was going wrong. I thought he was in real trouble. And even on Saturday, you know, he did haul himself up to the second row, but that required towing Jack Miller in FP3, towing Pecco Bagnaia in the first run of Q2, towing Fabio Quartararo in the second run of Q2. And obviously on Friday, he towed Aleix Espargaró, which earned him a lot of criticism from Aleix, like a lot. Very, very harsh words. But, you know, anyway, Mark never cares about that sort of thing. Doesn't bother him one bit.
He didn't care off the line, did he?
Nah, never does. It's amazing how unflappable Mark is to public criticism. Like he barely ever even like gets, he never even betrays being annoyed a little bit. He's always just, he gives off an like, "I'm above all of this" attitude. He just does not care. It's very impressive. It's very, very cool in a way. But anyway, so suddenly in the race, he discovered some pace that just didn't seem to be there for the rest of the weekend. And the way he puts it, it makes sense that he conserved his energy for the one session that matters. He probably should have been down at that final corner, honestly, and then it would have been a no score. So clearly he was pushing quite hard. Well done to keep it upright. And yeah, fourth was the absolute best result possible. Like if he'd cleared the Jack earlier, maybe he could have pulled away enough to where Aleix couldn't have caught up, but I don't really, like, Aleix just had more, like a lot more, and Mark is still, he's still figuring out this new Honda. He's smart about the way he talks about it. Like he makes it clear he's not annoyed in the least that they've changed the bike, even though he found the previous bike so much more natural. But you know, that just means that there are going to be days like this where fourth is the absolute best. He's not in the title race, but you know, he's obviously going to win a couple of races this season.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing, isn't it? Obviously, he is getting better, but when the absolute best that Marc Marquez can do is fourth after saving himself all weekend just for the race, we're a long way from 2019, Mark, still. And honestly, the longer this goes on, the harder it looks that we're going to see 2019 Mark back. I get that the shoulder's still recovering, but it's been six races and 6 months almost now that he's been back to training. And it shouldn't take that long to build back the muscle that he's lost, assuming that everything he's doing in the gym is concentrating on that, which makes me think that there is maybe just a weakness there, that things aren't as strong or as good or as quick reacting or whatever way you want to put it as they used to be. And that's far from ideal for him. He is adapting to the new bike still. That's very, very different. But the more the guys talk about it and the more that they have difficult weekends as opposed to easy weekends, the more it sounds like the new bike isn't massively different anymore. I think there's a big question mark about what level of Marc Marquez we're going to see whenever the full pack, whenever he feels like he is now as strong as he can be again.
It plays into a pet theory of mine that's I'm increasingly sort of thinking about. That might be complete rubbish, but just, is modern MotoGP too specialized and ultimately too close to allow riders to get injured and to take time off with injury and, you know, have surgeries and stuff like that, which they obviously, sometimes you just have to do it because your body's broken. But we've now seen multiple riders over these past 12 months have time off or have injuries that it takes them just an absurd amount of time to get back to their form from. Like, is Miguel Oliveira back to his Miguel Oliveira best since what happened at Red Bull Ring last year? Is Franco Morbidelli ever going to be back to the Morbidelli we know since his knee surgery? And is Marc Marquez ever going to recover from the time he spent off that let his shoulder, you know, wilt, I guess?
Mm.
It's because all of them have struggled to varying degrees, and you could argue none of them are back to their best yet, even though the injuries to those parts haven't been career threatening in a sense, but whatever has happened has been enough to knock them off their rhythm and knock them maybe off their fitness schedule. I don't know. Three completely different cases, obviously, but it's taking all of them very, very long.
For me, it's something different. I think that it's because MotoGP is currently constantly adapting and changing that the biggest problem is that you develop a way to ride a MotoGP bike and then the way that you ride a MotoGP bike changes underneath you. And that means that every rider has a life expectancy in terms of fighting for championships. And if you go back in time, it happened with Valentino Rossi. It happened with Mick Doohan. It happened with all of these guys because basically they're so long that, you know, you can ride for it. And in Mark's case, it's made even worse because he left. And then let's not forget, we had this massive technical revolution of ride height devices that are worth like almost half a second a lap. They completely change how you ride the MotoGP bike. Joan Mir was complaining yesterday that he thinks that maybe part of the problem that some teams are having at the minute comes in the Michelin tires because they've made such a big technical step that the tires haven't been able to keep up. And I think that is the reason that maybe we're seeing, you know, Marquez fading away. Like he won 8 titles in 9 years or 10 years, which is something that Valentino Rossi did. Then Valentino Rossi got hurt and came back and fought for titles again, but was never the same guy. And I think we're seeing a repeat of history.
Yeah. If I could be so bold, because I was there at the time, Mick didn't struggle with the bike. He just fell off behind the commentary box at Jerez, and that was it.
But the point is that regardless of the reason, I completely get what you mean, but regardless of the reason, every great champion gets a run and then it's done. Yeah, that's it. Always has to end, and it generally ends quite sharp.
Yeah, and Val has brought up a very valid point, actually, with those three guys of, you've had your time and you've had your moment in the sun and all those other one-liners from Sage comments and people and such like.
I'm not entirely sold, Val, on your theory with regards to Oliveira, because I think that KTM are in a world of hurt that is making him look really bad. But I completely with the other two. With Morbidelli in particular.
Yeah, he's the weakest link in that regard, because he's actually looked pretty good these past couple of weekends relative to Binda. But
yeah, and the other name that's worth throwing in there as well is obviously Andrea Dovizioso, who was a title contender, took a year off, came back and was nothing on the bike that won the championship last year.
And it's just embarrassing now. It's awful.
Yeah,
it's awful. Is. On a completely other side of the coin, Marco Bezzecchi, a rookie on one of the VR46 Ducatis. You guys gave him a score of 8.5 in the rider rankings on the race website. Qualified 8th, finished in 9th position. You're both fans, aren't you?
I mean, Simon gave him that ranking. I want to make that very clear. The numbers are Simon's numbers. Please do not at me on Twitter about Simon's numbers. They are Simon's numbers at Simon. Anyway, but yeah, I'm a fan. I would have, all that said, I would have also given him something like that. He was really, really good. It's another really, really good weekend for Marco Bezzecchi, who looks the undisputed cream of the crop of this rookie class, which I did not see coming. I'm not sure how many people did. But it's just crazy, the strike rate of Valentino Rossi on these young Italians. Congratulations. I don't know what the long-term plan should be for him at Ducati, like whether he has to be on a work spec next year, right? Or at least something close to that, I guess. It was he's adapting so much better than all the other rookies. And he's, like, the only problem is that he's still crashing kind of a lot. Like, I think he crashed during Q1, and I think there was a moment where he set the fastest time in Q1, and then 30 seconds later, he was down on the ground, which I described as the ultimate Marco Bezzecchi experience of 2022. But, you know, it's easier to make a fast rider stop crashing than a slow rider be fast. And Bezzecchi's, he's fast. He's fast in MotoGP. He's gonna be a stud. Congratulations, Ducati. I guess having 8 bikes works out.
Yeah. The only problem is that they have got the wrong rider on the factory bike at the minute, because Luca Marini is disappointing again. And I can't imagine a world in which, at the very minimum, those two aren't switched next year, so that Marini keeps his 22 bike for 23 and Bezzecchi gets a 23 bike instead of the 21 bike he's currently on. I just can't imagine a world in which that's not going to happen. I don't think there'll be a huge move to promote him to another team, because the VR46 team is an incredibly well-funded and well-backed and well-supported team, and there's no real desire to put him out of it. Why not just give him full factory support and let him stay where he is with his mates, with the guys he's worked with for decades, you know, and build something there? Because Ducati have shown us that they're not adverse to throw in factory bikes to anyone that deserves one. And why not? On an aside, I don't know if you saw the shot of the bike car park here at Jerez this weekend with like 10,000 motorbikes.
Oh, it was amazing.
Someone tweeted it with a caption saying 2024 factory or satellite Ducati lineup. They sent out a list of stats last night after the race. The factory press officer Artur sent out this list of amazing things that Ducati have done this year. As you know, the only manufacturer to have won races with two different riders, the only bike to have started from the front row in every race, 3 wins out of 6, and the only manufacturer to have been on every podium. That sounds very impressive until you realize that they've got 8 bikes and a third of the grid. So yeah, you would kind of expect them to be there every week, you know?
Now, you know, it's still very impressive because they've picked good riders for him. So, you know, congratulations on that. If we were suddenly to slash Ducati to 4 bikes, MotoGP would be worse off, unless we gave those other bikes to other manufacturers. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong, I'd rather see 6 Ducatis and 4 Aprilias in the grid next year.
Yes, absolutely. But, absolutely.
And the same for Suzuki.
I think a VR46 swap, actually, the way... So if they decide that current Moto2 points leader Celestino Vietti is not ready, which the way it's going, I know he has a Moto2 lead. I still think he probably could use another Moto2 year next year, the way I see it right now. So if they decide he's not ready, then I think my early verdict is that a swap in equipment between Bezzecchi and Marini within that garage would be good for both parties, because clearly Marini still has a lot to figure out. He does not need another equipment upgrade. He needs to get his head around what it is that he's doing right and wrong. Why is it that he can be a front row starter but can't last in the race?
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Very odd crash that befell Frenchman Joan Zarco at the Cito Pons corner, the long blind right-hander that goes up towards the crest of the hill. What did he say about that?
So he said he went into the corner, he took the front, and I think the reason that it looked strange is because he realized it was going, he realized that it was going to be quite slow, and he realized the best thing to do was to jettison off the bike quite early and let the bike and him carry on into the gravel trap. Otherwise, it would have ended up as like a Marc Marquez-esque middle of the circuit stuck there crash, which would have obviously been very dangerous running at the front of a race. So I think it wasn't quite the odd crash that it seemed once he explained that. Once you know that he kind of made the conscious effort to jump off it. It probably adds even more to what Marc Marquez did, though, because, you know, Marc Marquez is capable of saving those moments rather than having to make the decision to jump off them. And yet Zarco was able to push through it or Zarco was forced to push off it.
Coming back to Repsol Honda, his teammate Paul Espargaro, Marquez's teammate Paul Espargaro, I mean, he got 11th position come the flag. Was he even in the race?
Incredibly anonymous.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest, an incredibly disappointing day for all the Hondas apart from Marc Marquez. Paul had a very anonymous weekend, struggled with his old rear grip problem, which is just the last thing that he should be on a bike that was built for him to solve that issue. Alex Marquez had another also quite anonymous race. He made up good positions, I'll give him that. He came through the field well. I think he came 21st to 13th off the top of my head.
It's easy to make up positions when you qualify 68th.
Yeah, 20. Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
sorry,
and to me, it proves that last weekend was Alex Marquez being made to look good by the circuit. And then the other LCR Honda rider, Taka Nakagami, who was 7th, he had his Alex Marquez at Portimao weekend. This is his best week, his best circuit of the year by a long way. We know that. It always has been. But if 7th is the best he can do in the best weekend of his career, of his season, then...
you got a long summer to go.
Not even that. What a day to have a mediocre result at your best circuit whenever the guy that's tipped to replace you next year, Ayagura, won his first ever Moto2 race.
Yeah. I was going to say 7th is not the problem. 1st in Moto2 is the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's, it's funny. We had a, after Argentina, whenever Nakagami bumped into Mir off the line, Mir and I were talking after his debrief and he was saying I don't really know what Nakagami was doing today. He was riding like a wild man. He was never going to finish the race with those tires the way he was attacking. And I sort of jokingly said to him, did you see the Moto2 result where Gura just finished on the podium with his teammate Sankrit Chandra behind him for a Honda Team Asia 1-2-3? And Mir was like, yeah, that explains a lot. And the reality is now it's looking increasingly likely that we're going to see two new riders at LCR next year. I think that there are, so I got it confirmed over the weekend, there are definitely some form of talks going on between Jack Miller's manager, Aki Ayo, and Lucio Ceccanello about Miller potentially returning to there. If, as expected, he's bumped out of the factory Ducati team, Ceccanello doesn't really have much of a say in what happens on the other side of the garage because of the Idemitsu sponsorship, but Honda have given Nakagami all the chances in the world now after 5 seasons. And it goes the next big rising thing. So
they've given Nakagami a good MotoGP career, which, you know, ultimately, if I don't think he'll be walking away a failure if he walks away from MotoGP, but it's just time. It's time for Agura, I think. Simple as that.
And by the sounds of things, Honda will continue to look after Nakagami. There's talk about a world superbike seat. He'll go to Suzuka and win it 2 or 3 times, which will bump his standing in Japan massively. So, yeah, he's at a good innings.
Never feel sorry for them. One of my little expressions. Alex Rins, he wobbled to 19th this week after 4th the race before. Suzuki continued to lead the team's championship. That's a bit of a shame because I think you said in your rider ratings, Simon, that it was a bit of a return to the old Alex. But Val, what have you got to say about Alex Rins?
Oh, I mean, it's a return to the old Alex in that the Alex of 2021 in that the bike wasn't any good. So there's that. I mean, it was hot and the bike doesn't seem to work in the heat, which in our modern global warming world is, it's not great because we're going to have a lot of hot races coming up this season. I've been banging the I'm not sold on Suzuki drum for a while now, and I know it's getting old, but this weekend felt like a vindication in that regard. There is just no weekends where Suzuki is the bike to beat. And you know, they got demolished by Quartararo at Portimao and at Jerez. Neither Mir nor Rins were ever at the races. Now, Mir did salvage okay points, but he should have been at least in the fight for third if he's to retain serious title chances. And Rins, yeah, he fell, but he was only going to finish 11th or 12th at the max. Like, they're in a bit of trouble again. And look, I think there's equal chances, at least, of maybe Suzuki's a title contender, but maybe Suzuki doesn't win a race this season. I think those are equal, if I'm being entirely honest.
I think they will win a race, but who am I to know? Jorge Martin, did he crash out of 2023 already? Never mind yesterday.
I think that Martin, he's clearly riding above his limit at the minute. But I think that Ducati have a long-term plan for him that probably won't change because he's in a bit of a run of bad form. As Val said earlier, and as I've said many times in the podcast, it's easier to make a fast rider stop crashing than it is to make a slow rider go fast. And he has so much speed. We know that. Obviously, Ducati have access to all of his data, so they know that even more than us. And while a lot of the focus has been on Enea Bastianini this year, I think that there's still something more complete about Martin than there is about Bastianini. Traditionally, whenever you look back at the real talents, the sort of the first red flag that these guys are going to be something special is their qualifying pace in every class, even before they start winning races. And for me, that is still there for Martin. And I think once they sort the issues, which I'm sure they are working quite hard to do, then I think his future should be secure.
It is important to note that Martin is still a less experienced MotoGP rider than even Bastianini, owing to his spell on the sidelines last year after the nasty Portimao crash. That said, please stop crashing. Please stop. I mean, it's 4 and 6, right? One of those was not his fault. One of those was Bagnaia knocking him off, but it's not how it should be. We didn't hear from him yesterday, so probably not in the greatest of moods right now, as you should be, really. Needs to, ultimately, a factory Ducati ride has to be earned on the basis of this season so far. Bastianini has done more to earn it than Jorge Martin. That's, you know, that's not how Ducati's going to look at it, but it's, you know, Martin's going to have that somewhere at the back of his head for the next few races.
One thing that has been quite notable is that he doesn't like doing media debriefs when he's had a bad day, which is a bit of a surprise because he's always been quite a good media player. And I just wonder if that's maybe a sign of something that's changing within the mood or within the, you know, the temperament that needs to be addressed, as well as the on-track thing.
My experience of watching somebody who's mega quick and then starts to get it all wrong is, as we all agree, you know, once you're quick, you're quick. You've just got to slow yourself down just to stop crashing. He might have the wrong people around him. You know, you look at Colin McRae, you look at Marc Marquez, you look at Max Verstappen across three different walks of motorsport. They were always quick from day one. You just got to have the right person around you to morph you, to guide you. And maybe he's just not got that at the moment. Maybe they can't see the wood for the trees. He wakes up in the morning, he hasn't forgotten how to ride a bike. Let's give him time. Let's give him time.
It's also worth noting that the factory Ducati took a punt on Jack Miller with a somewhat spotty consistency record of his own. And while it's not quite worked out the way that maybe they'd hoped it to, he has won a couple of races for them.
And a few more. And they do have to take a punt, and not everybody comes up trumps. Brad Binder, top KTM, but as we've touched on already regarding Miguel Oliveira Val, it just was, what did you say before the broadcast, a weekend of pain.
Yeah, KTM's back to being 2021 KTM. Yes, that's basically it. There's really, really not much to be said there. There are still tracks where this bike does not work. There are still conditions where this bike does not work. It's not a huge shock, because you know the more likely thing was that they weren't going to fully make a massive U-turn from 2021 to 2022. There was always going to be some tracks where they're not so great, and I think I got suckered in by Brad Binder's second place finish in Qatar at a track where the KTM usually didn't work. But since then, Kota, now Jerez, have proven that there's still quite a way to go.
Dry races to qualify, Val's comments.
Yeah.
Remember, he did do quite well in Indonesia, but that
no, was yeah, but that was like the Qatar was arguably, it had the potential to be more informative. Mm. And maybe it still is, but yeah.
That actually leads in quite well to what I was going to say, because it seems like all of the issues are still to do with the chassis and swinging arm, which is why that things are a bit easier in the wet, because the problem's not with the engine or the electronics. It's, you know, yesterday both riders were complaining about rear chatter that had suddenly appeared out of nowhere in the race. And you think, like, that's not normal. For, you know, chatter is something that happens these days in certain conditions. You know to expect it. It's a bit of an Aprilia thing. There's certain conditions where they know they're going to get rear chatter, but for it to suddenly spring up out of nowhere is a bit unusual these days. And it all goes back to frame design. And we've seen in the past KTM like to try and engineer their way out of problems, and it feels. Because they can, because they've got this tubular steel chassis that's 3D printed and very adjustable and easy to change. And sometimes that's not the way to fix things.
They will do what they can. They will do what they can. And it's all about testing. And they're testing at Jerez the day after on the Monday. So Lorenzo Savadori, he had a wild card race at Jerez on the board the Aprilia. So did Stefan Bradl. Any little nuggets about what the pair of them were testing, or was it the usual closed shop?
Honda wouldn't even tell us what they had for breakfast, let alone what they're testing.
Very true. They wouldn't tell you what day it is, in fact.
Yeah, exactly. We'll try and leverage something out of Aprilia a little bit later.
Well, we know that Bradl was testing the gravel. So
stop it.
Stan. Sorry, Stefan.
Yeah, coming as a test rider whose job is to gather data and finish the race and then crashing twice is not ideal.
Yeah,
but you know. Mark loves Stefan. Stefan's not going anywhere, ever.
Well, bless him, Stefan. And I got a lot of time for him. You know, he'd finished his career and he keeps riding and he keeps riding and he keeps riding and he keeps riding. And he'll be sending the invoices in. Job done. So yeah, all good. Not a full house at Jerez, I noticed on the telly. Quite a few spare seats. Did you say there was, what, 50, 51,000 people there?
So Jerez crowd figures have been a bit unusual over the past few years. It was consistently 100,000 people attending every race. 100,000 on Sunday, 100,000 on Sunday. And then overnight it dropped to like 48,000 a few years ago. And it's kind of stayed there since. Everyone I spoke to who was in the grandstand yesterday says, no way, there was far more than 58,000 people here. And whenever you look at the shots of the bike park, you think, yeah, there's tens of thousands of motorbikes there. So whether or not there's a little bit of creative accounting or something like that going on with actual numbers for whatever reason, I don't know. But there's something that never feels quite accurate about the Jerez crowd figure.
I think what's happened is that a lot of race organizers, they over-egg the numbers to make it look good. But then, of course, they'll get clobbered with the books. So there's never 100,000 people there. I've been at Silverstone and there's 120,000 people there. You can't fall over. And it's a huge place, Silverstone. I mean, Jerez, I could bet you could put in the flipping South Circuit at Silverstone. And then what they've had to do is go the other way with the books and go to 50.
So there was a good crowd. It felt like a good crowd. It felt like old Jerez with a load of atmosphere, yeah. But let's not read too much into actual numbers.
Nah, it looked
this
pretty...
This is Andalusia. The numbers are nothing.
Yeah, it looked good. It looked good. Valentino Rossi, he raced at Brands Hatch yesterday for the very first time in his career aboard his Audi R8 GT3 car that he's racing. He had an 8th and a 14th position, just to bring you up to date, but I'm sure his phone was red hot with WhatsApp messages back and forth to Jerez. FIM, they confirmed some technical regulation changes for 2024, when it will be mandatory in all GP classes to use a fuel with a minimum of 40% of non-fossil fuel origin, so sustainable fuels. Sustainable fuels come from agricultural waste and such like, and there can be a blend between the two of them. All sorts of different teams in different forms of motorsport are using a blend, some up to 80% of sustainable fuel with a 20% fossil fuel additive. But that percentage will be increased to 100% sustainable fuel used in Grand Prix motorcycle racing in 2027 onwards. Other things that are happening with regards to sustainable fuel: Le Mans 24 Hours, they're going to be 100% sustainable fuel this year. Dakar will be 50% sustainable fuel next year. So it's on the horizon.
Yeah, and the reason that Le Mans is leading the way in particular is because the technology that we're using and they're using is being largely driven by Porsche. Porsche have built a huge new plant in South America, in Chile, that uses wind power to convert seawater into hydrocarbons, basically. So there's zero carbon emission from the actual process, and it's fully renewable. That's what we're using. That's what a few of the teams here have already been playing with. You remember both Suzuki and KTM experimented with a new fuel from a company called ETS a few years ago that you could actually smell running in the bikes. It smells sweeter out of the exhaust of the bike. So it's not an unusual, an unknown technology for this paddock. And when I've spoken to engineers in the past, they're quite excited about it because it's something else that you can tune.
Exactly. The Porsche plant in Chile is a multi-billion euro operation, multi-billion, and they are very much set on it, Porsche. More and more sustainable fuel manufacturers, for want of better expression, are coming through. So, you know, if you're wondering what agricultural waste is, you know, they cut the corn off the cob. The rest of the plant is then mushed up and made, as it is in South America, for a lot of methanol. So instead of it being ploughed back and then the carbon being released into the atmosphere, it's been harnessed to go racing. So it's not using fossil fuel in a different way. So, yeah.
Also worth noting that another place that has been driving synthetic fuel technology along quite nicely is Qatar, which obviously is a country that has a very close relationship with the MotoGP Championship.
All of the Dorna and Erta and FIM guys have been dealing with BP, with ETS that Simon has mentioned, Repsol, Shell, Total Energies, which is Total, should I say, and Petronas, who are all pushing that forward. Also announced best Grand Prix of 2021. You know the answer to this, Simon, but what was your best Grand Prix of 2021, personally?
I think my best Grand Prix of 21 was probably, in terms of sort of what the criteria for this vote is, probably Misano, because Valentino's farewell was quite well managed, and it was where we won the championship with the big race. I think Valencia got a little bit lucky in winning the award by dint of being the only race that was allowed full attendance last year. So a bit of an easy victory for them, thanks to reduced COVID restrictions.
Yeah.
More of the famous anti-Valencia agenda from Simon.
Oh, dear. Stop it. Stop it. So always a good vibe in Jerez. Any other news and scuttlebutt from around the paddock?
Usual complaints this weekend about race control and the FIM stewards being massively inconsistent. Ayumi Sasaki gets sent to the back of the grid in Moto 3 for touring in the racing line, where basically when we looked at the video, he hadn't been touring in the racing line. He ran off the track because he outbraked himself and then joined into the back of three others who were touring in the racing line, and they penalized penalized three of them, including him, but not the guy at the front of the touring group, Izan Guevara, who qualified on pole position and started from pole position while the others were sent to the back of the grid. Big crash in Moto3 warm-up involving Joel Kelso. Poor Aussie got wiped out by a ghost bike after Ortola fell off it.
Terrifying.
After contact with Ricky Rossi, who was then given a long lap penalty for sitting up in the straight. who then tweeted me to tell me that Race Control had agreed with him that he didn't deserve a penalty and had reduced it from 2 laps to 1 lap because they couldn't rescind it because they'd already announced he was being penalised. So I have no idea. The FIM stewards room is the Department of Mysteries of MotoGP. It is just what goes on in there ain't connected to what goes on the track anymore.
Pandora's box. Things go in, thing goes out.
Yeah.
Well, what to say? We've had Qatar, Indonesia, Argentina, Texas, Portugal, and now Jerez. 6 down, 15 MotoGP races to go. Next up will be the French Grand Prix at Le Mans. The reigning MotoGP champion, the championship leader, Fabio Quartararo, will be going to the Circuit de la Sarthe, the small version, the Bugatti circuit, as that championship leader. What a weekend he's going to have next time out. He puts his leg over that Yamaha M1. Keep in touch with all of our news through the-race.com. In the meantime, from Val, Simon and myself, Toby, enjoy your week. Tune back in again very soon. Bye for now.
The Athletic.